It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. While school is out, we are going to do some learning together on Talk of Iowa. Learners of all ages are invited to join our Tuesday conversations with wildlife biologist Jim Pease about wildlife and wild places here in Iowa. On Thursdays, we're going to focus on Iowa history. And to prove that not all history lessons are depressing, later in the hour, we're going to talk about Iowa in the 1920s, when concerned citizens and policymakers tried to ban jazz music and dancing. But we are going to start with a difficult time in Iowa history. With COVID-19 spreading worldwide, you've probably heard people talking about the flu pandemic of 1918, sometimes called the Spanish flu. Iowa was not spared during that time. Today, our guide through Iowa history is Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And for people who aren't familiar with the history of this flu pandemic, and we often call it the flu pandemic of 1918, but it lasted for several years. Give us an idea of the scope of this pandemic.
Sure. It was a illness, the virus H1N1, really that caused it, and it developed first in the spring in Kansas in 1918, but then came back in the fall, and ultimately it killed about 50 million people worldwide. It truly was a global pandemic. In Iowa, the number of deaths were 7,000, a bit more than that. And tens of thousands of Iowans were afflicted by the flu in small towns and large towns. And so it was it had to be a terribly frightening time for people and alarming in September, October, and November, especially of 1918.
Absolutely. And I know that sometimes those numbers are hard for us to wrap our minds around. So we've invited someone to share a story with us to really put a human face on this flu pandemic. Shannon Miner lives and works in Iowa City today, but her family was living in Iowa 100 years ago and had a tragic encounter with the flu. Hello, Shannon.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And you shared a picture the other day that led me to this story. You shared a picture of two caskets lying side by side, a picture that was taken in 1920. And in one of those caskets was your great-great-grandmother, Amanda Johnson. So before we find out what happened to her, tell us about where your family was 100 years ago. Where were they living?
So the majority of my family on that side, that's my dad's family, would have been in northern Calhoun County and southern Pocahontas County, right around the Pomeroy area, farming.
Okay, so they were a farm family. And
yes,
as I mentioned, there were these two caskets lying side by side. Tell me about your great-great-grandmother, Amanda Johnson, and how she got sick.
So Amanda was sick because she had contracted the flu, most likely. She was also incredibly far along in her pregnancy, about to have a baby. And there's some family lore about how the flu came to the farm. Whether it's accurate or not, we don't know for certain. But we do know many members of the extended family had already been battling the flu and were struggling when Amanda went into labor. And then she died the next morning after giving birth, likely because of both the stress of having the flu as she labored.
Wow. So, and did that child survive?
That child did survive. Her name was, at birth, also Amanda Christine. She legally changed her name to Ruby Johnson years later.
I mentioned that there were two caskets in that photo, and shortly after your great-great-grandmother died, her sister, Hilda Peterson, also died. Tell me what happened.
So Hilda was the older sister, and she had actually raised Amanda, and she went to visit her sister, even though she had been told, you can't go see her. She's unwell and quite sick. And she went anyway, and then she died very shortly after, also of the flu.
And of course, I'm sure the family hoped that it ended there, but it didn't. What happened next?
Within the next few days, another sister of my great-great-grandmother, Amanda, also succumbed to the flu. Her name was Anna, and Anna was 37 years old, and she died as well the following Wednesday morning, so within 3 days.
Oh, so much sorrow for one family. And your great-grandmother was 4 years old when this happened, but did she remember that time?
She did. She spoke quite a bit with my father. They were very close. My father spent a lot of time actually on this farm growing up, and because it stayed in the family. And she would tell my dad that what she mostly remembers is standing by that coffin and crying and just begging her mother to wake up.
Oh, wow. So at this time, it's special that you have this family history preserved and these memories. I know there was a newspaper article that told this story, so that helps keep the story alive for many years. But right now, with a virus pandemic sweeping the world, you must be thinking about this story a lot. What's going through your mind?
What I am thinking about is that even though during that time they were practicing social distancing, all of the church functions were being canceled, they still didn't quite know what to do to stop this. And I know we have so many advancements in medical science from 100 years ago. I just think about my young great-grandmother, Evelyn, who I adored in my childhood. But my son is close in age, and I just think about the tenacity that she was forced to face, as well as the people that survived. And it makes me think that we have choices to make right now, today.
Well, I think about her sister who just desperately wanted to see her before she died, and of course then contracted the illness. Not going would have really been against every impulse she had as a sister. I think that's one of the things that makes this story so tragic, but also so familiar to us.
Absolutely. I feel that. I would want to go to be near the people I love the most, because that would be my opportunity to connect. Unfortunately, that is not the right decision to keep us all well. And I think it goes against our very nature as social human beings, and yet it's what we are all called to do right now, to stay safe.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for sharing your family history with us today.
Absolutely, Charity, and thank you for the opportunity.
Shannon Miner lives and works in Iowa City. Her family was living in Iowa 100 years ago, and three women in the family died within a space of a week. Her great-great-grandmother, Amanda Johnson, and Amanda Johnson's sisters, Hilda Peterson and Anna Peterson, all passed away within days of each other. We're talking about the flu pandemic of 1918, and of course it continued on. These three sisters died in 1920. With us to guide us through this history is Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And Leo, there are so many stories like the one that Shannon just shared. When you dig into history, so many families lost so much, didn't they?
It really was, as we said, and Shannon communicated too, just how devastating it could be in communities and within families. And so we think of this as today's time as being unprecedented, but it's because I think the 1918 pandemic, even though it was the centennial a couple of years ago, is so far removed from our consciousness that we don't realize how alarming it was even back then.
Now, you mentioned that this flu emerged in Kansas in the spring of 1918 and then traveled around the world and came back again. Often we hear this flu referred to as the Spanish flu. It seems like maybe the Kansas flu would have been a more appropriate name for it. But why do we call it the Spanish flu?
That was a country that wasn't involved, and Michael Lewick-Thrams has done some good work on this, too, and been on the show in the past. But Spain was a country not deeply involved in World War I. The King of Spain had contracted the flu, and so it was associated with him and the Spanish people, and so was often labeled as the Spanish flu because of that prominence.
Well, and you mentioned World War One. Of course, the flu pandemic was not the only enormous thing happening in our nation's history, in our world history at that time. And the fact that this flu pandemic hit during World War One makes it just even more extraordinary. But I can imagine that it also helped it to travel.
That's exactly right. The international travel that was taking place with soldiers in large groups as well. So you had the chance of a respiratory illness being virus being communicated between men, between nurses, between doctors, and those large groups of men. You know, at Camp Dodge, there would be 40,000 men or tens of thousands of men there at one time in barracks. And so and that is what happened when a soldier who had been in Massachusetts affected by and contracted influenza came to Camp Dodge. It then, in late September, started spreading through Camp Dodge. So that was one vector of spreading is those soldiers moving around so much and in concentrated areas and the social contact taking place that way.
Well, and we think about 100 years ago, and I guess a lot of us would assume that Iowa would have been kind of protected, maybe somewhat remote during that time. But you mentioned Camp Dodge, which was really a hub for the military, wasn't it?
It certainly was. As we said, there were, you know, at any one time, more than 30,000 men at Camp Dodge. And so there was a day in October, October 8th, where 996 men were diagnosed. So in a 12-hour period. So if you look at a 24-hour period, you could say 1,000 men at Camp Dodge in a single day were diagnosed with influenza.
Wow. All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll talk more about the flu pandemic of 1918. Our guide through this Iowa history is Leo Landis, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And you're welcome to join this conversation. Do you have family history with this? Do you have some questions about it? You can give us a call, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we are digging into Iowa history, and we're going to do that every Thursday while the schools are closed. Also, in a few minutes, to prove that not all lessons from history make you feel sad, we're also going to talk about the 1920s in Iowa when concerned citizens and policymakers tried to ban dancing, or at least certain types of dancing. But right now, we're talking about a very difficult period in history, the flu pandemic of 1918. We know that this flu emerged in Kansas in the spring. It spread rapidly. It went to Europe. It came back. It spread all over the world. And we've been talking about how it played out here in Iowa and some of the things that we can learn from this history. Leo Landis is here with us, curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And we have an email, Leo, from one of our listeners talking about Camp Dodge. He said, the other night while I was doing some deep cleaning, I came across a series of articles about the flu's impact on Camp Dodge. It was a World One training camp, or World War One training camp, as we were just talking about, and 702 soldiers died, mostly in October of 1918. There were gruesome stories about how quickly the bodies were piling up and how many were never embalmed. There were rumors of an unmarked mass burial ground near a pioneer cemetery, although that has never been verified. That's from Tim in Des Moines. And I mean, this is difficult history to revisit, isn't it?
It is. And it does offer some, you know, maybe perspective, too. We think, again, about it being unprecedented. The state of Iowa, then the oversight was from the State Board of Health. Our secretary, who was a medical doctor, Guilford Summer, actually did declare a statewide quarantine on October 17th. He had consulted with the United States Surgeon General Blue about that. It telegraphed was the communication at the time. And so we actually did have a statewide quarantine beginning on October 17th, 1918. Different localities had their own quarantines, either before Ames had put one in effect earlier that month, Des Moines on October 10th. And so we have had, you know, the distancing guidelines even at that time.
How do you think that news was spread? Of course, right now in this age of information, we know immediately when somebody makes a recommendation, but then news traveled a little slower.
The newspapers really were the main communication device. So the larger towns had daily newspapers, Davenport, Des Moines AM, Sioux City, Cedar Rapids, across the state. There were dailies. And I think he was looking to do that on a Thursday because a lot of the weekly papers came out on a Thursday as well. So then signs would be posted in shops as well. So it was a way to get the news out in a timely way. For all Iowans. And again, Ames and some other towns had actually had their quarantines in effect earlier. And the Ames quarantine really was the Iowa State campus and the area around it, not so much downtown.
I'm sure Ames was a much smaller town during that time. It's interesting to note how local leadership varied from town to town, with the quarantines going in at different times, but also being lifted more quickly in some places.
I think, especially with the Student Army Training Corps, both in Ames and Iowa City, as part of that World War One ramping up to train young men, you had concentrations of soldiers or men training to be soldiers, and so in those confined areas, not that there weren't other dorms and things, but with the international travel, you saw it spread in those communities faster. Or at least develop sooner. Same with Camp Dodge. And so, you know, you had that interchange, and with tens of thousands of people or hundreds of people in tight quarters led to the spreading in some of those communities sooner.
Well, and we think about soldiers and how it affected soldiers during the war. Of course, there were many people involved in serving at that time, including nurses. You have a story of two nurses who were lost. Can you tell me about them?
Yeah, because we never thought we were going to be in a conflict that big, the state of Iowa, the historical department at the time, tried to document all the Iowans who died in service. So we have over 3,900 photographs of Iowans who died in service, and we counted the nurses, so our number's a little larger. But Kathleen Kennebec was a nurse who was trained out of Carroll County. She was from West Central Iowa, and then Irma Shaw, who was from Denison. Both were nurses headed to France in October of 1918 on different ships. But Kathleen Kennebec, she contracts the flu, dies on board, and is buried at sea. Excuse me. And then Irma Shaw, her parents, Alice and Leslie, were a little more prominent. Her father, Leslie, had been Secretary of U.S. Treasury during the Theodore Roosevelt administration, so he was nationally significant. And when Irma Shaw dies, they bring her body back from Europe, and so she is buried in Denison. And you know, both of these women would have had, you know, promising lives ahead of them, and were two victims of that influenza pandemic who were trying to serve, you know, Allied soldiers during World War One, but contracted the flu as they were headed over, and they both died in October of 1918.
So if you look at our losses of Iowans in World War One, give me an idea of, you said about 3,900, so just about 4,000 Iowans were lost during the war?
So our number is over 4,000. We have photographs of over 3,900 of them. Of that group, more than half died of disease, so around 2,300 die of disease. And of that 2,300, 13,054 of them die in October and November. So about a quarter of the Iowans who die in service die in the month of October and November of disease. And so it's one in four. It's just staggering to think of.
At a time when so many people were being called to serve the country and being drafted to serve the country, do we know if there was a tremendous amount of fear about also contracting the flu because you were drafted? I mean, I just imagine that stories of these deaths were traveling everywhere.
You know, you read the letters and the accounts of men. There's certainly an awareness, and there's certainly, you know, wanting to avoid large groups at times. But you were being impressed by the draft to serve, and so you didn't really have a choice. So there certainly would have been a fear, but you also did. I mean, there's the awareness of trying to keep your distance. And not really having a choice when you were taking a ship over to France.
Absolutely. So maybe they came from a community that was quarantined and trying to stop the spread of the flu, but suddenly you're in a barracks with many other men. There was no way to stop it. And of course, the flu did not discriminate by age by any means. Let's go to the phones. 866-780-9100 is the number to call to join the conversation. You can email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. James is on the line. Hi, James.
Hello, yes. When I was in the guard unit about 10 years ago, we were stationed out of the building that was supposedly the morgue at the time. It's a big three-story building, probably the biggest building at Camp Dodge.
And so you talked about the fact that you thought that it was the morgue. Was that were there
well,
some legends
yeah,
that were shared?
Rumor has it.
Yeah.
Rumor has it. It was kind of creepy to spend the night in there, especially if there was only a couple of you. But it was, like I said, it was probably the largest building at Dodge and probably still is close to it. It's a big three-story building.
Well, James, yeah, thank you for sharing that with us. And I know that we can dig into Camp Dodge history. A lot of that is really well documented. But, Leo, I want to move out from Camp Dodge, which, of course, is the place where so many people were together. But again, let's go to our communities and talk about how it was playing out in communities. And one of those towns that we know a little bit about is Jefferson, because there are some records about how the town doctor responded to that. Tell me what we know about that.
Yeah, Tom Moraine of Graceland University and did his book, Prairie Grassroots, a number of years ago. Really has some excellent stories connected to Jefferson and how the flu pandemic played out in Jefferson. Of course, in the period of a town around 3,500, I think, at the time, they had 600 total cases. But one of the stories Tom talks about is Dr. Charles Blake, C.W. Blake of Jefferson, and it's Thanksgiving Day, which was November 28th in 1918, and Blake is doing his rounds because he's working because of the pandemic, and he's having dinner is how Tom describes it. I bet that's the noon meal. And so he's having noon meal with a farm family, the Winey family of rural Greene County. Again, the phone communication at the time, and that would have been another way that you could have heard what was going on in your community, because if you're in a rural community, you all essentially share the same phone line, and it's the operator who can contact you by doing your farm family or your home ring. And so
and a lot of people picked up on any ring and
exactly,
listened to whatever was said on those party lines.
Exactly right. We know that from other conversations. And so C.W. Blake is having noon dinner on Thanksgiving Day with the Winey family. He gets a call from the operator who he had told, I'll be at the Winey farm at this time. And she said to him that we've had 54 patients report the flu that day, and could you go out and make calls to these different farms? And so he takes Wayne Winey, the 16-year-old son of Maude and Will, along with him, and they travel around rural Greene County visiting farmsteads, and they stop at one farm. Four family members are all ill in the household. The entire household is ill. They're too weak to make dinner, or make a meal. So while Blake is tending to the family at that farmstead, he asks Wayne to make a soup for the family. So that's the level of service, you know, that we're getting from our first responders and medical doctors across the state. But that's what was going on then, is, you know, spending the rest of your Thanksgiving Day going from farmstead to farmstead and taking, you know, a 16-year-old boy along with you to make food for them if they need it.
Well, and to think about the town operator was basically his medical assistant or his at least his secretary,
for lack of a better term, yeah.
Right, and then this young man who also good thing he knew how to make soup. Young men of the day did.
Right. The other story connected to the Wineys is Wayne's sister Wilma was a Drake student at the time, and so she was coming home for a visit and talks about being at the depot in Des Moines and just seeing rows of caskets lined up 4 or 5 deep, being sent back to home counties out of central Iowa, and so it really was where. Again, the transportation system for mass transportation is either streetcar or rail car to communities. And so I do have to imagine the somberness that you would feel when you were in a depot and seeing a situation like that.
In going back and finding personal stories about the flu pandemic, and I know you have several that maybe you can share a couple others with us, but why is it important to preserve these stories?
It's the history of medicine. It's the history of the social and cultural and political reactions as well when we're in times of stress. And I think it can, be a inspiration and a maybe way to consider the situation we're in to say we can persevere through this. We can overcome the challenges we're facing. And, if we abide by recommendations of health experts and political leaders, we'll be better for it. And so in the conversations you've had in the past, it's why is this forgotten? I think it's not just that World War I was going on, that it was such a traumatic experience. And talking about death is a difficult in such mass numbers is so difficult that it was not something you brought up in polite conversation. And so for us to have this conversation, encourage Iowans to reflect on the past is a way to help us move through the future.
We have this email from Janet. She says, my grandfather, who was born in 1897, was to go to World War I, but he never got any further than Camp Dodge. He said that he fell ill with the flu and lay in bed in an infirmary with many other ill soldiers. He said the soldier on one side of him died, then the one on the other side died. He thought that he would die also. They were so short of nurses that he laid in his own waste for a period of time. He did survive and actually lived to be almost 102. She also says, my great uncle, who served in World War I, was in France at the time of the flu outbreak. He told me that he stayed in a barn and would crawl out into the sun every chance he had. He too survived to reach the age of 85. So some extraordinary survival stories as well. Now, something that we're talking about, here we are in a presidential election year of 2020, and people are concerned about voting. That was an issue back in 1918 as well.
It was. Of course, it's an off-year election, so it's not a presidential election.
Right.
And it's important to remind Iowans that only half of our adult population could vote then. We're on the centennial of women's suffrage, and finally, U.S. men saw fit to give women the right they deserved in 1920, at least across the country. And Iowa was one of those states that had not done that. So we only had half the voting population. But that was a situation where Dr. Guilford Sumner had issued the quarantine, things were starting to get better by late October. And so in the November 1918 election, it really didn't have an effect in Iowa anyway on voting. The sense was that the flu was starting to recede, even though that wasn't totally the case in some communities, but that there was enough social distancing taking place. They felt like they knew how to run an election. Again, it's not a presidential election. There would have been a gubernatorial election in Iowa at the time because we were only every 2 years for the governor's term at the time. But it was something where we'd also just put in absentee voting in Iowa in 1916. That was the first year we had an absentee voter law in Iowa. It was mostly designed for traveling salesmen, but at least in 1918, the effect on voting in Iowa wasn't significant, and so there really wasn't an effect at that time.
There are so many things that were changed by that pandemic. It took us a huge stride forward in science and medicine and public health, and we're not going to get to all of those subjects today because our time is up. But Leo Landis, stay with us. We're going to talk about a different period in Iowa history in just a moment. Leo Landis is the curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Every Thursday, while schools are closed, we're going to be digging into Iowa history here on Talk of Iowa. Every Tuesday, while schools are closed, we're going to learn about Iowa's wild creatures and wild places with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. School is in session for learners of all ages on Talk of Iowa while our physical schools are closed. On Tuesdays, we're learning about wild creatures and wild places with wildlife biologist Jim Pease. On Thursdays, it's Iowa history. Now, of course, history is fascinating, and we need to prove that not all history lessons are sad. We can learn a lot of episodes in history that may seem strange or even funny today. Now, after World War I ended and the flu crisis lifted, a number of Iowans started worrying about something else that was spreading like wildfire, and that was jazz music. That's In the Mist by Iowa native and musician extraordinary Bix Beiderbecke. The sound was new. It made people want to move in new ways. Leo Landis is curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. And Leo, you recently wrote about this period in time in the 1920s when Iowa tried to ban dancing. So set the scene for me. We know the 20s are the jazz age. What was going on?
Sure. So jazz music had started taking off really late World War One, late 19-teens. But with the war going on, really the nation had been focused from April of 1917 until 1919 on the war effort through 1919. And then as, we're going back to a period of normalcy, as President Harding had said, but young people who we're being exposed to new music, and so this is one of those lessons where, people are always concerned about what young people are doing. Jazz music and the type of dancing that was taking place with jazz dancing became a concern across the country and across our state of Iowa with dances like the Bunny Hug and the Texas Tommy, the Shimmy. So there were a number of, dances that were causing concern across the state. Cheek-to-cheek dances is what they were called.
All right. So people were standing very close together when they were dancing, and they were also moving more quickly than some of our more traditional, a little more distant dances. This was very concerning to the moralists of the time, huh?
Exactly right. And so across the state, you really saw local ordinances being put in place, again, in small towns and large. And it actually carried over into broader social culture. Even before the war, Billy Sunday, who was a native Iowan and was a nationally famous preacher, had been warning against the tango as the rottenest, lowest down, vilest, filthiest, and most corrupting dance ever invented. But again, that's the 19-teens with the tango, 1914. 1921, things really become concerning, both with the automobile and with the dancing. And so you have reactions across the state with local ordinances about them.
Well, and let's talk about the automobile, because, all of a sudden, a lot of people had cars, and that gave a lot of people freedom. And before that time, young people might go riding out in a carriage together, but there was a lot more chaperoning going on before the car, right?
That's exactly right. And as a tribute to any college teaching assistant at Iowa State or University of Iowa, this is a story I learned when I was an undergraduate at Iowa State University of the concern over what were called petting parties. And so as a, you know, a first-year student in the 1980s at Iowa State, I'd read a article in my History 221 class about petting parties. And so it was something I had in my mind when I was researching World War I and the aftermath for our exhibit at the State Historical Museum. And I just decided to see what I could find on petting parties. And the Burlington Hawkeye on July 10th, 1921, not on the front page, but ran a full-page story on petting parties as a popular pastime. So good alliteration there.
Yeah.
But it was concerned that, you know, here are young people getting in automobiles, parking on secluded country lanes, and, you know, kissing and other things in the privacy of their automobiles. And so that was another factor leading to the moral decay of the United the American youth.
Wow. Well, and if you have family stories about this time, these are some of the stories that get passed along as well. We'd love to hear them. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So when communities tried to ban cheek-to-cheek dancing, how was this enforced?
Most larger towns had, and even mid-sized towns and small towns had, you know, their own police force, but also would have a police matron or two. Sioux City actually put together a board of police matrons and local women and had a couple demonstrate different types of dances, and the you know, kind of the morality board of these 20-some women, 20-plus women, were viewing the different types of dancing and said, you know, oh, that dot dance is appropriate, that dance is not. The Sioux City Journal, in their article on the police matrons in 1926, talked about, you know, they had a photograph of a cheek-to-cheek dance that they called naughty, and then they had a more appropriate distance between the couple that was a nice dance. And so there actually were local boards making judgments, at least in some Iowa towns, or the law enforcement of the local town, both women and men, keeping an eye on things.
So if someone was caught doing these kinds of naughty dances, what could they do to the person?
Yeah. In the case, you typically, in Ringsted, one of the early towns, so a northern Iowa town, north-central Iowa town, or northwest, that was a place where you would be banned from the dance hall for a period of time. Usually it was only the person hosting the dance that might be prosecuted. So Rolfe, Iowa, passed a dance ordinance in the spring of 1923, and it lists, you know, that jazz music is strictly prohibited, that all indecent, immoral, or suggestive dances are not permitted, and would list them again, the usual suspects are the grizzly bear, the bunny hug, the Texas Tommy. But usually the penalty was only on the dance hall host. And so in the case of Rolfe, you could be penalized somewhere between $5 and $100 and not to exceed 30 days in prison if you were hosting an indecent dance. And just as indicative, and we haven't talked about prohibition, and that may be a topic for you in another show, but to show that prohibition wasn't really having an effect, part of that ordinance in Rolfe also banned intoxicating liquor at public dances. So even though it was already banned nationally, they felt responsible to reemphasize that alcohol was banned at dances in Rolfe.
All right, to create a double ban for moonshine and anything you might get from bootleggers at the time. And how long did this period last? Because the jazz age, although we think of it as the 20s, there was concern about this kind of music and this kind of dancing well into the 30s as well.
There was, and part of it is, you know, there truly is a national reaction. Henry Ford, when he builds Greenfield Village, puts a dance hall at Greenfield Village so he can promote more traditional appropriate dances. The Iowa State Fair actually institutes its old-time fiddling contest at this time, and I'm certain almost that that's a reaction to the jazz music and wanting to emphasize, you know, more appropriate fiddling music. And so into the 1930s, you start to then see a little bit of an ebb in the concern as musical styles change more with swing and Latin influences that aren't quite as and it's part of the nature of things today, too, that styles change. There's a reaction that against the not necessarily reaction against, but just things change. And so it's like, oh, that was great in the 1920s, but we're going in a different direction now.
Well, there had to be an element of racism to this as well, because we know that jazz music originated with African-American musicians. And of course, white musicians also started playing that kind of music, and there was segregation of the bands, et cetera, and all of that. But this reaction to the music, whether it was overt or not, must have had some racial roots as well, I would think.
It definitely did. I mean, there were sometimes it would be referred to as jungle music in the newspapers across Iowa and across the country as well. And that jazz was explicitly called out and banned. I think there was not think I can, you know, find a number of instances where it was being connected to African Americans and is being vulgar and would lead to indecent and immoral behavior. So we have a poster in the collection at the State Historical Museum, where a jazz dance is taking place outside of Des Moines in a smaller community. And it wouldn't surprise me if that was because it would have perhaps a bit less oversight and not be as offensive in a more rural setting. It wasn't a town, it was a rural setting, and so it wouldn't raise perhaps as much of a concern. And that was part of the rise, in fact, of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s across the Midwest, was the reaction against African Americans, Catholics, immigrants in general, that you saw in our state and across the country. And so that was part of the reaction as well.
Now, of course, we're talking about city ordinances, so towns that said you can't do these kinds of dances, although the churches also worked hard to enforce this as well. I do have some family history with this. My grandfather, Carl Nebbe, was the leader of a dance band in the 1930s and 1940s, and he was excommunicated from the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church that he attended because of the lewd music that he played and how it encouraged people to do inappropriate dances. So the churches, I'm sure, were very active in trying to stamp this out as well.
And I think it would, depend to a degree. Maybe it didn't depend to a degree on denomination. It was probably a generational thing, at least around some of the other issues of the time, especially on prohibition and temperance. Catholics were a little more sympathetic to a local option and a choice on things, but I would wager that Catholic priests and denominations all across the state, I don't know that there were any that were sympathetic per se toward jazz dancing and the what were seen as immoral dances. And so in the case of your grandfather, that was, pretty typical in many communities and across our state.
Well, and we're all familiar with the advice from dances at Catholic schools to save room for the Holy Ghost in between the two dancers. So who knows, maybe that originated during that time as well. But I look at these names of these dances, and of course, I've got kids at home learning TikTok dances right now, and we did things like that when I was a kid, although we didn't have the internet back then. But I look at the names of some of these dances, the kangaroo, the toddle, the moonlight, the Chicago, with the grizzly bear, the shimmy, the bunny hug. The only name that you mentioned in your article that I recognize is the Charleston. So I can just imagine these community leaders trying to outlaw these dances that people were just naming on the fly. And you outlaw the kangaroo, I'm just going to, make up a new dance.
And that's one where if there are any young people listening, a lot of these dances, some classical dancers have put up YouTube videos of the style of dance, or there are even some period film clips, since by this time you've got motion pictures becoming more and more common. So if any of your listeners, both old or new, there's the article that the Des Moines Register ran, and they can look for that online, but also... because the Des Moines Register has been supporting Iowa History Month, and we're grateful for that. But March is Iowa History Month in Iowa. And if your listeners want to try to track down the article, they can Google Footloose Iowa Ban on Jazz Dancing, and they can find the article. But also then Google some of those names, and either on YouTube or other formats, find examples of those dances.
Yeah, maybe we can bring them back on TikTok today.
You can have your children demonstrating them, Charity.
Yeah, I'm sure they're cringing right now because they're listening, unless they just turned it off in embarrassment. So, you know, a lot of people like to joke about how, you know, we may not exactly repeat our history, but it rhymes. So as a historian, when you look at this period in the 1920s, and then you think about the other periods, when we were so horrified by the dancing of Elvis Presley, for example, and when we were horrified by the Lambada back in the 1980s, do you get some interesting perspective as a historian thinking about those different times that are so similar?
It really does, again, give you the perspective on we're always worried about what is happening to our country, our state, and to keep in mind that those concerns about, oh, the good old days, we're losing those connections. And I think as Iowans, we still do try to seek out social interaction that are positive, and that what we think are threats to our society may not really be a threat to our society, that it's always been the case. And just to be mindful that these trends come and go, and that they're really not the threats that we see.
Right. We all just need to relax a little bit. Leo Landis, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's always a pleasure, Charity.
And Leo, before you go, I'll let you know that my son, who's 12, just texted me and said we were literally just doing TikTok dances. So
good to know.
They're gonna learn the grizzly bear this afternoon for sure. Leo Landis is a curator of the State Historical Museum of Iowa. We're going out today with Hot Lips by Paul Whiteman, and I'm sure that the name of that song refers only to the hot lips of a jazz musician when they are blowing that horn. We'll have more Iowa history next Thursday and more about Iowa's wildlife and wild places on Tuesday while school is out. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.